Okay, we are in the Gospel of John. I love the Gospel of John. Gospel of John is Matthew, you know. Matthew's making a hard run for my favorite gospel, but John still has a special place in my heart. John 8:58 is one reason why, one of the clearest revelations in John of what it is that John is actually doing. John 8:58. Very truly I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. And then verse 59, at this, they picked up stones to stone him. But Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. One of the things you'll notice in John's gospel is Jesus is always in control. Always in control. They come to kill him, it just says he slips straight through them. Now exactly how this happens, frankly, I don't care. The point is, in John's gospel, Jesus is being depicted in a certain way. His identity is being given to us in a very clear way. But a couple of elements in John 8:58 and 8:59 need to be teased out so that you know exactly what it is that he's saying here. First of all, 8:59 is the weird verse. They picked up stones to stone him. And the question naturally would be why? Matter of fact, what's even weirder about that is the first two words of verse 59. At this, when he had said this, it was this statement that caused them to pick up stones to stone him. Which is weird whenever you read back over what he said to them so far in chapter 8. I mean, my goodness, Jesus calls them children of the devil earlier on. He says that you are children of a liar, which is the devil. That's why you can't understand what it is that I am saying, because you're a slave to sin. You are not children of Abraham, verse 39. If you were, then you would do what Abraham did. As it is, you are looking for a way to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. Abraham didn't do these things. You're doing the works of your own father. Who is your father? The devil. See, he's pretty in their face. And yet, as he's in their face, they're not picking up stones to stone him. It says, you're children of the devil. They don't pick up stones then. You're not children of Abraham. They don't pick up stones then. So the question becomes, what is it that he says in verse 58? That at this, they pick up stones to kill him. The answer is Exodus 3:14. Before Abraham was born, I am. What's happening in Exodus in chapter 3, verse 14? What's happening? Do you remember? That's the Old Testament. The burning bush. Moses has already, you know, been born. He's been saved by going into the very heart of the nation of Egypt. He ends up being raised by Pharaoh's daughter, ends up killing an Egyptian because he was beating ruthlessly a Hebrew once he got older. Then the Hebrews basically, in a sense, rat him out. He runs away, goes in the desert, and is wandering around, and gets married, wandering around with his father-in-law's flock of sheep in the desert. And then he sees a bush that is burning. But he notices the bush is not burning up. But he notices that the bush is definitely burning. But since it isn't burning up, he's like, well, what's happening? So he goes a little closer. And then God uses this as an opportunity to speak to him. Moses, Moses, you know, you take off your sandals. You're on holy ground. Remember this? And then God says, I have a mission for you. I want you to go and set my people free. And Moses says, okay, but actually, I think you got the wrong guy. I don't think this is me. I'm a stutterer. I don't really do very well speaking. You want me to go talk to Pharaoh? That's not going to happen. I even killed the guy. Remember that? You've got the wrong person. God says, yeah, I don't make mistakes. So go set my people free. He says, well, okay, let's act like I accept your mission. What am I going to do? Go tell them, burning bush guy told me to come and set them free. No, no, no. God says, this is my identity. The identity is, I am who I am. You tell them my name, and my name is I am. I am has sent you. And in Greek, this name of God, I am, which definitely has a relationship with the name Yahweh on some level. But this I am name has a Greek form, ego eimi. Ego eimi, which literally is I am, an emphasis on the I. So whenever you would say ego eimi, on some level, you could be indicating with that construction that you're speaking the name of God. Back to John chapter 8, verse 58, it says, very truly I tell you, before Abraham was born, ego eimi. Why do they pick up stones to kill him? He's claiming the name of God. And that's a much different category than just calling me names. If you're a Jew, you can call me sons of the devil. If you're a Jew, you can call me a liar and we can just fight about it. You can call me not a child of Abraham and I will argue with you. I'll even pull out my genealogy and prove it to you. If you claim to be God, I'm going to kill you. Because that's called blasphemy. And your honor is not as important as your God's. And they would even kill for that. Jesus claims the name of God. They pick up stones to stone him. Why? Because that's blasphemy. A mere man cannot claim the name of God. John's gospel is emphatically trying to emphasize the identity of Jesus is divine, is God. And that's what happens in his genealogy. He does have a genealogy. I don't care what anyone says. His genealogy is in John chapter 1, verses 1 through 2. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. What is his genealogy in John? Trace it all the way back to. What is the origin of Jesus? He's God. He is God. He is the Word, the Logos. But the Logos is God. I don't care what the JWs say on that one. No, sorry. You're not going to add an A. He was a God. You can't. Actually, it's syntactically that doesn't make any sense. No. And the Word was God. What would have been scandalous, though, for the... Because actually, if you'd have read that in a Roman culture, they would not have been upset initially. Because the Logos was this kind of ethereal force on some level. This is woefully simplistic. But it was the creative force, the mediating force between humanity and divinity. It's kind of like you have divinity, the Logos type force, and then humanity. The Logos is the means through which creation has its being. The Logos is this mediating force. They would have been like, yeah, the Logos on some sense was God. What's scandalous to them, though, would have been verse 14. And the Logos became flesh. What? No, that's not possible. The Logos is the force from which flesh can come, but the Logos itself can't become flesh because it is the mediating force between humanity and divinity. If the Logos becomes flesh, then what do we even have? That's not possible. For the Greco-Roman world, the Logos becoming flesh is what is scandalous. And yet for Christians, that is what's most comforting. You see the oddity of what he's doing here. He's saying the identity of Jesus is something that shatters all categories, whether we're talking Greco-Roman or Jewish. It redefines all terms, whether Logos or monotheism. The revelation of Jesus as defined, where God himself becomes flesh to dwell among us, shatters everything that we've understood about even God himself. This is a Colossians 1:15 moment. This is what we talked about at the very beginning. Why start with Jesus? Because he's the image of the invisible God. Because he is the revelation in the most clearest sense of the word. Of that which we only partially understood in the Old Testament. He is the Word that becomes flesh to dwell among us and reveal to us not just who he is, but who the Father is. And John's gospel hammers on this. As a matter of fact, in chapter 14, Jesus says, I and the Father are one. If you've seen me, then you've seen the Father. And Philip asked the dumb question. Remember this? We've gone over this a couple of times already. Philip asked the question, man, Jesus, if you would just show us the Father, can you show us the Father? That's all we really need. It's like, well, my goodness, I guess you're asking for very small things now. And Jesus gets a little upset, though. He looks at Philip and he says, what? Do you have any idea who I am? Don't you know that if you've seen me, then you have seen the Father? Why? Because don't you know that I and the Father are one? John's gospel is emphatically saying Jesus is God. And he actually does it in a couple of different ways. I love John because of his literary depth. I love John because of his theological prowess. He just doesn't apologize for articulating things so clearly. There are seven different times throughout the book of John in which Jesus says some form of I am, and then there's a predicate that follows. I am this. I am this. There is the one time in 8:58 where he just says, I am. But that 8:58 should flavor every other time we see I am something throughout the book of John. And there are seven. Why is that significant? Yes, it is a number of completion. It is a number of completion where he's saying this is the complete revelation, not just of Jesus, but of God. This is who God is. This is who Jesus is. I am, very first one is in 6:35. I am the bread of life. Comes in a very interesting context. Jesus has just fed the 5,000. And shortly after he says, I am the bread of life, on some level, because they think he is then the new Moses. They're not looking for a divine figure in that moment. What they're looking for is another king. That's what they're doing. They're looking for another emperor to basically kill the emperor. That's what they're looking for. And Jesus gets angry. Why? Because he's not that type of king. You're not going to fit him into a box. He looks at him and he says, No. If you think that I'm just a new Moses, you've drastically misunderstood who I am. I'm not a new Moses. I'm bigger than Moses. I am the bread of life. I'm not just the one that prays for it and then it falls. I am the one that has come from heaven to give you providence, or give you provision, to give you sustenance in the desert. I am the very bread. So eat my flesh and drink my blood. Again, that's very weird in order for the Romans to try to convince Jews to follow a nonviolent Jesus that they would have stuff like this inside of their propaganda. A Jew would be like, yeah, that's not only not kosher, that's just gross. Really? You're wanting me to eat the flesh and drink the blood of... And what happens in John chapter 6? What happens? What's that? After the feeding of the 5,000, after he preaches the sermon that says, drink my blood and eat my flesh, what happens? They leave. It goes from over 5,000 people, 5,000 men, not counting women and children, down to 12. And Jesus looks at the 12 and he says, you going to leave too? And I love Peter there. He says, to whom will we go? You have the words of life. Jesus says, I am what? The bread of life. I'm not just a new Moses. I'm bigger than Moses. I'm the provision that actually is given that if you eat and feast off of me, you will have sustenance. Especially in the desert. John chapter 8, verse 12. I am the light of the world. It's interesting because in Psalm 119, 105, God's word is called the light. The light that illuminates our path. The light that gives us, in some sense, the means by which we can even walk through the path. That is the light. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law, but he is also the word, and therefore he is the light of the world. He is the guide. He is the one that provides illumination. He is the one that provides our guidance, which is a very godlike thing in the Old Testament. You know what I mean? In the Old Testament, the provision of God's word, the provision of God's law, the light that would guide you through the darkness in order to actually arrive at the threshold of the temple of God was given by God himself. And now Jesus says, yeah, I'm doing that. Why? Because it's not just a claim of my mission, it's a claim of my identity. Who am I? I am the light of the world. And anyone who walks in my light will never walk in darkness. John chapter 10, verses 7 and 9, Jesus also says, I am the gate. And this does go back to the concept of whenever a shepherd would be on some level, now granted there are different intricacies to this metaphor, but this is not an invalid one. Whenever a shepherd would be watching his flock at times, he would function as the gate to the pen of the sheep. He would sleep there. Even to this day, there are times whenever the shepherds that are out there watching the flocks in some of the different nomadic communities, they will sleep and be the gate to protect the pen. Therefore, if anything comes, they're there to protect. They are the ones that are the gate. No one gets through the door. No one gets through the door without first going through the shepherd. He is the protector. He is the authority. He is the one that offers the stronghold, the protection inside of the shadow of his wings. That's one of the things I love about the word Passover, and we'll talk about this once we get there. But in the Old Testament, the word Passover wasn't just this concept of doing one of these, just going over the top of something. Oh, it just passed over. Actually, the word Passover has a much more active of kind of more of like this. where it's not something that the angel of death is doing, passing over. It's something that God is doing whenever the angel comes. It's different. That's what's happening. So whenever the angel comes to this house in order to take the firstborn, all of a sudden he has found a God that's protected, that it says is he finds a gate that he can't get past. And that's why he moves on. So don't think Passover. Think Passover. It's different. We'll get to that more once we get to the Lord's Supper. But that's the concept here with the gate. I am the gate. They cannot get into you because they have to go through me first. I will protect you. I will fight for you. Because I am. Chapter 10, verses 11 through 14. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. What does that remind you of, Old Testament wise? The good shepherd. Any ideas? Any Old Testament text come to your mind where you're going, huh, that's a very important shepherd text? So that is it? Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. Lord there is in all capital letters, which is indicating what? Yahweh. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not lack. I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down by green pastures. Why? Because I need to rest and I need to make sure I eat and have my sustenance. He guides me by still waters. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Why? Because I have a good shepherd. And the good shepherd, Jesus articulates it even more clearly in John chapter 10. He says, the good shepherd, I am the good shepherd, he says, which is a divine claim on some level. I am the fulfillment of Psalm 23. He says that as the good shepherd, a good shepherd will lay his life down for his flock. Therefore, the cross is inextricably linked to his identity, which also points to his very divinity. I am the good shepherd, because whenever the evil one comes storming after you, he has to come through me, and I will lay down my life for you. I am Psalm 23. John chapter 11, verses 25 through 26. The situation with Lazarus, Jesus waits a couple days too long, 4 days to be exact, goes to his friend, they come and run up to him, Mary and Martha, and they say, oh, if you'd just been here. And Jesus says, don't you have any idea, though, about the resurrection? And they basically look at him and they're like, well, we know that at the end of one day we will see him again because everybody will be resurrected. Which is very interesting that they know that. Jesus had to have told them that because that's not a very commonly Jewish thing, a general resurrection. Look in the Old Testament for it. You'll find it in two places, Daniel 12 and then a couple places throughout the Psalms that kind of seem to indicate it. Other than that, not a very normal thing. Intertestamental period, kind of. It builds up steam. But an actual consistent belief in the Jews of a general resurrection, well, the Pharisees and Sadducees can't even get their notes right on that. But Mary and Martha have it down. And Jesus comes to him and he goes, yeah, but I'm not talking about that resurrection. He says, don't you know that I am the resurrection? That I am the giver of life? On some level, the concept of a resurrection, it almost is a little bit misguiding that we have the words R-E at the very beginning of that. Because that's why I like it more. It's the concept is he is a giver of life. He causes to rise up. In the same manner that in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28, God gives breath, gives life, and causes to rise up that which had no breath in life. Jesus says, yeah, that's what I am. I'm the one that breathes life into your nostrils. I'm the one that gives you the breath. I am the resurrection. And if you find me, you'll find life. That's one of the things, man, I tell you what, I was even reflecting on this morning as I was typing and praying. So I sat there and thought, I was praying for my kids. I pray for my kids pretty much every day. And I say pretty much because I'm sure there's a day I forget. I don't want to be a liar on things that, anyway, doesn't matter. I pray for my kids pretty much every day. And I sit there and I thought, and I was praying for their purity today. And that kind of just seems like this ho-hum, oh, praying for purity because that's what Christians do thing. But actually it's no, because I truly believe that that is life to the fullest. Don't get me wrong. It doesn't mean you can't have life to the fullest if you were not pure throughout high school. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying a part of our narrative is if you actually follow the words of Jesus to a T, it should lead to life. And I'm not going to feel bad for that from my own history, and I'm not going to wish something different from my kids for their history. He is the giver of life. And therefore, he's either lying to me whenever he says, be pure, wait for your spouse. Either he's lying to me that this is life, not life to the fullest. It actually isn't. Real life to the fullest is doing whatever you want and then getting forgiven for it later. We treat our stories that way sometimes. We even don't celebrate people's stories sometimes that have just never really done anything bad. Well, part of the problem we don't celebrate is because we're afraid of making other people feel bad that have done bad things. I get that. And there is a place to make sure we say, but it's okay if you've done things bad because you can still have life to the fullest. Nevertheless, man, there are memories that plague me even to this day from high school that I wish never happened if I would have just been pure. And I wish my kids protect that from them for their entire life, and I will not apologize because I think their life will be more enriched. I will not be convinced that past sins make you more complete. No, they give you a different type of struggle and a harder fight. They can be overcome, but it's not life to the fullest. You understand? In other words, I would never look at Jesus and say, you never actually lived. Why? You didn't experience the sin I did. Really? That's what we're going to accuse him of? Jesus, you goody two-shoes. You just didn't live life to the fullest. YOLO, Jesus. YOLO. You see the weirdness of this? And that's just ridiculous on multiple levels. No, he's the giver of life. And maybe the things he actually instructs you to do, maybe on some level, you should actually say that it would lead where he says it leads. If he is who he says he is, and he says he's I am. I mean, it's really weird to me that the one that actually we believe created us doesn't have a better idea of the best way in which you should live. He made you. He created you. I would expect for him to have a better perspective than me on what it is that I can do or should do. I would expect it. Otherwise, I don't really understand our relationship. He is the resurrection. He's the giver of life. And his words can give life if you actually follow him, which leads to the fourth one, or the sixth one, John 14:6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Oh, what's so weird about that is an inclusive verse. He's saying, so come. Come, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one can come to the Father except through me, so come. And yet, that's considered one of the most exclusive verses in the entire Bible. That's to keep people out. No, it's to bring people in. That's the whole point. It's an invitation. It's not a rejection. I am the way, the truth, and life. He's revealed it to us. Thank God he has. And yet somehow, Satan and his, masterful intellect has transformed this into an ugly passage that we don't preach from, and when we're assigned to, we almost shy away from. It's just not very seeker sensitive. Oh, but what if we give them what they've been longing for their entire lives? And what if we're honest with them? It's like, no, don't get me wrong. Any truth that you find in other religions, it probably is true. But it only actually can be measured of its truth based on how much it does or does not reflect Jesus. And when it doesn't, it's not true. And when it does, it is. But he is the barometer of truth. He is the revelation of the divine God that says, you want to know what truth is? Here it is. Measure everything off of this. And you will find gradated approvals of truth. That's like, you know, I look at the ethics of Mahatma Gandhi and I'm going, wow, that actually looks more like Jesus than some of the Christians I know. And yet, it doesn't mean that I think Mahatma Gandhi is a Christian, because he's not. He's a Hindi. He's Hindu. He doesn't want to be a Christian. And to force him into that box is a little strange. We've hijacked Mahatma Gandhi, now he's ours. No, he's not. And yet, it doesn't mean there's no truth in him at all, inasmuch as he reflects the truth, Jesus. You see the difference in that? Does that make sense? Oh, there's all just a bunch of truths and throughout all religions and all of them are kind of pointing to the same thing. Well, no. There's still a barometer from which we actually gauge what is true and what isn't. And the answer is, it's not an objectivity, it's a subjectivity in the sense of it's a subject, it's Jesus, it's a person. He is the truth. He doesn't give you a didactic list. He gives you a story. That is the truth. And I know that we're time. Oh, we're way over. Okay. We'll pick up the vine next Tuesday. Love you guys. See you next Tuesday.